learning can only happen once well-being is in place. If a child is very dysregulated, distressed, not able to be calm, there's no way they're taking in any information. So you have to meet those needs first. There's the will, and there's £4 billion of investment over the next 3 years to try and make it happen. I think whether it will bring costs down, whether it will lead to a solution to the problem is really going to be all in the implementation.
The Special Education Needs and Disability, or SEND system, in England has reached a critical juncture. Astonishingly, 1 in 5 children are now identified with special educational needs and disabilities. The number of Education, Health and Care Plans, EHCPs, has more than doubled since 2015. Overall spending is rising explosively at between £2 to £3 billion a year. Yet resources are not keeping up with this explosion of demand, nor are they spread fairly across the country. Diagnosis times are too long, and whether you get the care needed depends on where you live and how hard parents fight for their very distressed kids. Many feel the current system simply isn't working. The government has recently suggested significant and vitally necessary reforms to the SEND framework. Its SEND white paper simultaneously tries to cap the growth of spending through tiering the level of need into 4 categories, while also allowing a focus on the most needy. But why has demand grown so explosively? If unchecked, at current rates of growth, by 2040, approaching a majority of kids could have special educational needs. Palpably worrying, with all that means for our economy and society. It has become crucial to understand what's driving the demand, what responses best work, and to close gaps in the evidence base. Joining us today to discuss the challenges facing the SEND system is Alice Reeves, Research Grants and Programs Manager for Education at the Nuffield Foundation. Alice oversees a broad portfolio of education research with a particular focus on special educational needs and disabilities, as well as children and young people's mental health and well-being. Alongside her professional expertise, Alice brings invaluable personal experience. As the parent of a child with autism and ADHD who struggled in mainstream education, she has first-hand experience of navigating the education system and advocating for the support and opportunities children need to thrive. Quite an introduction, Alice. Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, the most obvious question is, why has this happened over the last kind of 12 to 15 years? What's driving it?
Yes, that's a very complex question without a straightforward answer. I think there are a number of different factors. So if you'll bear with me, I'll sort of take you through some of them. So I think one of the things that it's important to recognise is that we currently have a 2-tier system of SEND support. So about 14% of children receive some level of support for a special educational need or disability that's covered by the school without the need for involving the local authority or getting a statutory plan. And then we have this 6% who have these education, health and care plans that you mentioned, the EHCPs, which are legal documents that set out these are the child's needs, this is the support they need and that must be delivered.
So that's 14 plus 6 equals nearly 20%.
Exactly, that's right. Just over 20% according to the new figures that came out very recently. The growth over the last decade, there has been a steady rise in special educational needs overall, but the really steep rise has been in EHCPs, so at this higher level of need, which so schools have a notional budget of £6,000 per pupil in their core funding to meet higher than average needs. And when they feel that they've spent that £6,000 and they still can't meet need, then there's an application to the local authority. So it's these plans that have been rising really, really steeply. And one of the reasons for that is constraints on schools' core budgets. So there was about a 10% real terms cut in school funding over the period 2010 to 2020. They then came back up to sort of 2010 levels, but costs had risen for all kinds of different reasons. And the costs of SEND support had actually outpaced inflation. So that strongly incentivized schools or put them in a position where they had to apply for extra funding from the local authority to cover needs that perhaps if their core budgets had kept pace, they would have been able to cover without applying for the plans.
So part of this is sheer accounting. That's not the entire story, is it? I mean, there's a deep set material, a psychological kind of educational need emerging? I mean, and why now rather than in previous decades?
Yeah. So I think there are sort of two categories that of driver apart from the funding situation. One of those is increasing recognition of neurodiverse conditions such as autism and ADHD, which really the evidence shows is previous underdiagnosis. So in the past, for example, we weren't very good at recognizing autism in girls because all of the medical research had focused on boys, and it can present very differently in girls, and they tend to be better at masking their discomfort and their needs. So some of this is to do with clinical understanding advancing, and so people getting diagnoses who would have in the past probably just struggled at school and maybe not had great outcomes, not great exam results, maybe found it difficult to make friends, but wouldn't have been noticed as having a SEND and given any support sort of to deal with that. So that's the first category. And then the second category is, I think, you know, types of need that have genuinely been just rising for different reasons. So one of them is quite positive, actually. Advances in neonatal care have meant that babies who are born very prematurely or with complex health conditions are surviving into childhood who previously wouldn't have. And that's bringing needs into the system and often into the special school system. Others are sort of more concerning, really. We know there's been a mental health crisis, particularly amongst adolescents. The latest figures from NHS England show that the proportion of young people with a probable mental disorder went up from about 1 in 8 in 2017 to about 1 in 5 in 2023. And obviously there's been lots of debate about that, around the causes of that, the role played by social media and other factors. And then people working with young children have also reported that they're seeing declining levels of school readiness, children's development being delayed, coming into school with speech and language difficulties, sometimes problems with emotional regulation and that kind of thing. COVID obviously played a part in that and in the mental health crisis. And there are other factors like defunding of Sure Start, which gave vital support to young children to help identify special needs early and stop them from escalating. And also the cost of living crisis probably plays a part because it affects parenting practices. It may mean parents are less engaged with talking to their children because they're working very hard and very stretched. So that's a whole category of needs that have been on the rise well. The other thing I would say is I think it's really important to remember that SEND is an extremely broad category. People tend to sort of know people who have SEND and focus on the types of SEND that they have, but it covers everything from learning difficulties, social communication difficulties, speech and language, social, emotional and mental health, as well as the neurodiverse conditions. And it also covers sensory difficulties, so anything associated with hearing and vision, and physical disabilities. So once you start to think about how broad it really is, that 20% possibly doesn't look quite so surprising.
And could, if we're not careful, at current rates of growth, I mean, it could double again in the next kind of 15 years. I mean, it's a really alarming prospect. Mm. But, I mean, I know a number of Labour MPs who represent disadvantaged constituencies, and they tell me it's not unusual in some of the primary schools for kids as old as 8 years old to come into school in nappies and simply be unable to use a kind of knife and fork at lunch. I mean, it's kind of an extraordinary. I don't think sitting in a pleasing studio here in the Borough High Street, we're kind of aware of the levels of deprivation that some children face.
Yes, I think that's right. And we know that these needs are more common and more severe in deprived areas. And of course, the early years before you come into any kind of childcare or education are absolutely vital for children's development. And if parents are in a situation where they can't do what's necessary to support their children's development, then the professionals who encounter them at age 4 or 5 or whatever are faced with having to, you know, bring them on. And COVID definitely played a part in that. I think children were less able to socialise with one another and so on.
I mean, I talked about the near doubling, or the doubling, in fact, of EHCPs When you described what's driving all this growth at the very beginning of the podcast, you identified that as one of the kind of drivers.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it'd be good to disentangle what is actually about incentives in the system for schools to apply for these,
mm-hmm.
and what's underlying demand. Can you give me some idea?
Mm. I think it's very difficult to put a percentage on it. I mean, I think if you talk to teachers and school leaders, they'll say, you know, in the past, we might have been able to deal with certain needs from within our own budgets, but our budgets have been so constrained, you know, energy costs going up, everybody's costs going up. Often they're having to bring in external specialist expertise like, you know, physiotherapists or occupational therapists or speech and language therapists. Their fees have gone up. So that definitely is a factor. But I think the drivers of actual increases in need are also there as well, and those other factors that I mentioned, including increasing recognition of neurodiverse conditions, are really important. I mean, the rise in EHCP applications has been primarily driven by autism and speech and language issues.
Let's make this live. I mean, give us a sense of the kinds of behaviours that teachers and parents are having to deal with, and what it's like.
You mean the kinds of behaviours
with a child who has neurodiverse
conditions?
And the ongoing stress on actually those who are responsible for parenting or teaching him or her, you know?
Yes. My son, as you said, has autism and ADHD. He actually also has a third form of neurodiversity called dyspraxia, or developmental coordination disorder, which affects motor skills and balance and spatial awareness as well. And it was that was noticed first, because when he was a toddler, he was not doing very well at getting the shapes into the holes and catching a ball and things like that. And of course, neurodevelopmental issues often are comorbid with one another. So it's common for children to have more than one. So in his case, the challenges at school were mostly to do with social communication. He found it very difficult to make friends. He sort of didn't relate to other children his age, was very often on his own on the playground. And also to the sensory demands of the school environment. So he found it very noisy, overstimulating, bright lights, lots of children running around. It made it very uncomfortable for him. He was more upset than misbehaving. But of course, there are other children who will express their unmet needs through disruptive behaviour. And often they're the ones that the schools are forced to deal with first, rather than the ones who are internalising. And often it's the parents then who see the fallout when the child comes home after school.
Managing that is kind of problematic, I mean, to say the least. I mean, you know, and actually must have come to dominate your entire life, actually, at times.
You know, it was difficult. It affected my son's mental health when he was young. And then when he was in year 9, so about 14, having tried a number of different schools, we ultimately decided that he needed to learn from home. So he actually schooled from home with an online school for 2.5 years to take his GCSEs, which was not a panacea, but we felt was the best available choice for him at the time. Pleased to say he's now gone back to in-person school for sixth form, which he's finding much easier because he doesn't have to be there all day, and the other kids have matured a bit and he's grown a bit more resilient, and that seems to be going okay. But through that process of online schooling, I got to know quite a lot of parents who were in a similar position, where they tried their best to find ways to keep their children in school and ultimately had found that they couldn't, just because the environment was too difficult for them to learn in. And clearly one of the things you really learn is that learning can only happen once well-being is in place. If a child is very dysregulated, distressed, not able to be calm, there's no way they're taking in any information. So you have to meet those needs first for any learning to occur.
This season of the We Society is brought to you in association with the Nuffield Foundation. For more than 80 years, the Nuffield Foundation has funded research and innovations that sit at the heart of some of society's biggest challenges. Evidence has the power to change lives, whether it's improving educational outcomes, reducing inequality, or understanding how society is changing. The Nuffield Foundation's work helps policymakers and practitioners tackle complex problems. To find out more about the Foundation and its research centres, visit nuffieldfoundation.org. Let's just kind of change gear again. I mean, that was very vivid. What are the proxies for stress on the education system? I mean, what's happening to teachers? What's happening to schools?
So, yeah, teachers are under a lot of pressure. You can imagine if you've got a classroom of 30 kids and you're seeing all these different needs, you know, it's not just the level of need rising, but it's the diversification as well. You know, teachers are very good at adapting their instruction to meet different children where they are, but it's a pretty superhuman demand on them. I think it's also really important to recognise that teaching assistants and other support staff in the school play a really vital role in meeting the needs of pupils with SEND, whether that's by taking them out for small group instruction in numeracy or literacy or something like that. Or some teaching assistants are actually assigned to a specific child through an EHCP to be with them all day to help them. And then there are these professionals called SENCOs that schools have, special educational need coordinators, who have more expertise, have had special training and can support teachers in meeting the
needs. It's a small industry, in fact.
Yes, and an industry that's very stretched. So SENCOs at the moment spend an awful lot of their time on paperwork and bureaucracy for EHCPs. And I think they would like to spend more time actually working with children and with teachers to make it happen in the classroom.
Now, grappling with this is obviously a policy priority. I mean, in every dimension. I mean, for the kids themselves, obviously, for parents and families, but actually also for the national budget and actually for kind of mainstream teaching. I don't think it's too much hyperbole to kind of imagine that if unchecked, we could find ourselves as a national community in 10, 15 years' time having very sizable parts of every classroom in SEND categories. So that begs the question of what does mainstream education then mean? I mean, it's really, what do we need to know that we don't know at the moment? You commissioned research at the Nuffield Foundation.
Yes.
What gaps do you think in our knowledge we need to kind of fill?
I think the really big one is what actually works for supporting children with SEND. So we funded a team based at UCL's Institute of Education to carry out a review of the evidence on, this was small group interventions to support the academic development of pupils with SEND from 0 right up to 25. And they've used the results of that review to create a database that practitioners can use to, it's searchable, so they can say, I'm looking for a numeracy intervention for children in Key Stage 2 with these kinds of needs, and they'll find what evidence-based practice there is, and they'll be given details about the strength of the evidence and how to acquire the program and so on. But through the review that underpinned the development of that database, the researchers discovered that the data was extremely patchy. And that was for academic outcomes, not even broader outcomes like behavior and well-being, which actually they're going to now go on and review as well.
So what's your hunch? As you commission this research, what's your hunch about, you know, what works?
I think there's an enormous amount of practice out there that teachers know works, but we're not collecting the information about it. So I heard, for example, about one school where teachers would write on post-it notes, you know, this is what I tried with my class, and put it up in the staff room and somebody else could try it. What we haven't got is really robust evidence. And as part of its reforms, the government has convened an expert panel who are going to develop a set of national inclusion standards, which will set out, you know, this is what you should be doing to try and support with these kinds of needs. But I think what they're going to find is that the evidence base is actually very variable. So they have, in the white paper, they did say that they would spend several million pounds trying to build the evidence base, but obviously that takes time. So I would think the first draft of those national inclusion standards will have to draw on evidence with a wide range of strength and robustness.
The white paper was widely welcomed, or saying welfare reform, you're walking on, you know, thin ice the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the government managed to get this white paper through without, you know, too many kind of
a rebellion.
Without a rebellion, and actually is now going to implement it in 2029. I mean, it has two objectives. I mean, objective one is actually designing a system that works And objective two is trying to keep as many kids as possible in mainstream education, both for their own good, but also for the good of the education budget and the national budget, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a white paper at the minute.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think as stands, it's likely to kind of work?
So, yes. So just to talk a bit more about what's in there, I mean, basically, their clear focus is on making mainstream education more inclusive so that more children can go to mainstream schools. And they're proposing to do that through increased funding, training to upskill staff in supporting children with different types of SEND. They also want every secondary school and an equivalent number of primary schools to have something called an inclusion base, which is a room or a space within the school that offers more tailored provision for certain pupils with SEND, so that if they need some time or to spend all their time outside the mainstream classroom, that provision is on the same site or in the same building.
I can imagine that's kind of stigmatizing. I mean, I can imagine that, you know, mainstream kids are kind of playing in the playground and you with SEND are kind of going off to the special designated room. I mean, it's not exactly kind of a mark of Cain on your forehead if you're kind of 12 years old.
Yeah, that is a really key concern about it. So they exist in schools already. They're not always called inclusion bases. Sometimes they're called SEN units or resource provisions. Some research that we funded recently by the National Foundation for Educational Research included a survey of school leaders. Less than half of those who were running some form of inclusion base felt that it met the needs of all the pupils who were attending it. And significant minorities said that pupils were not integrating well with their peers from the mainstream school in the kind of model that you suggest.
Yeah.
I think there are ones that work really well and are properly integrated and the staff work together. So the staff from the base with the specialist expertise support the classroom teachers and children might move in and out during the course of a school day. But I think there is a real worry that it becomes kind of a holding pen.
Yeah, and, well, that's it.
Yeah, for children that the teachers can't handle in the classroom.
There's going to be a bottom tier. I said bottom's not the right word. A category universal,
mm-hmm.
another category targeted plus. And when we get to then the kind of, you've got severe problems, your specialist care package. And that by having those categories, you hope to kind of keep as many children as mainstream as possible and really focus resource in the specialist care package cohort.
That's right. So you'll need to be assessed as having needs at the specialist level to be eligible for an EHCP. So the goal is that it's only those children with the most complex needs who would need an EHCP, and they'll mostly be either in a special school or in some of these inclusion bases will be specialist bases commissioned and funded by the local authority rather than by the school themselves. So they might be in a specialist base. So it is going to reduce access to EHCPs for a certain tranche of children with quite high level needs, but that don't qualify for specialist provision. And that's what's causing the most concern amongst SEND parents.
Have we reached a moment where we have to kind of acknowledge it's kind of last chance saloon? Unless this white paper works, if the numbers keep on exploding, you're going to get a demand from schools, parents, and kids actually, that actually mainstream schooling and SEND schooling must take place in different locales. Reading the background material before doing this podcast with you, I became, God, you know, I hadn't really taken on board how profound this all is and what kinds of tough decisions may have to be taken in the next 10 years unless we solve it. Your view?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's really important that we ask these quite sort of profound questions about what education is designed to do.
Yeah.
And whether the system that we've basically had pretty much unchanged since the 19th century is now meeting those goals. I mean, it's something that I've obviously thought about a lot because of my personal experience.
Yeah.
So when my son was schooling from home, we were obviously concerned that he might be isolated, and school serves this social
just
function
clear,
as well.
Just remind listeners and remind me, did you have to get a plan for him? I mean,
I did have an EHCP for him,
did, yeah.
Although I did not get funding for the online school. I had to pay for that myself and was in the lucky position of being able to do that. But, you know, had I not had those funds, I would have been seeking for the local authority to cover those costs.
Right.
So I managed to find a really wonderful, I should give them a shout out actually, the Garage in Norwich, which is a drama centre and a professional theatre as well, had really great SEND provision. And my son was quite interested in theatre and performance. And that was where he got his social interaction alongside doing the learning from home. And it made me think about, is our basically one size fits all, albeit that the government is now trying to sort of support differentiation within a mainstream school. You know, have we got it wrong? Like, should we really be asking, you know, how can we get all the children into the school building? But actually, how can we provide a good education and a good life for every child? And might that, the answers to that look quite different for different children?
Well, that's what I pondered as I read the stuff. I thought, you immediately hit a resource constraint. I mean, I know kids that I wish I'd stumbled on it myself when my own son was in his early teens. But I mean, boys love drums. But, you know, I mean, you know, to kind of spend a couple of hours making a racket with some drums, you might have got some of the things that were troubling him out of his system. You know, just your reference to a drama school made me think of that.
Yes, yeah. And I think, you know, schools have become very narrowly focused on exam grades, and it's only rational on their part because that's the performance and the accountability framework that they're given. So I think one of the questions is, do we need to measure schools' performance in different ways? So since November last year, Ofsted have been inspecting schools for inclusion. It's one of their new criteria. But performance tables still just look at performance in exam grades. So I think without broadening that performance and accountability framework, it might be quite difficult to really embed inclusion across the whole mainstream education system, every school, because you're at the moment you're kind of asking schools to act against their own interests in being inclusive, and, you know, because it may bring their exam results down. And we know from some research that the National Foundation for Educational Research did for us recently that some schools do actively resist enrolling pupils with SEND. Usually it's because they don't feel they have the capacity to meet their needs, but also sometimes it's to protect their performance metrics. And the problem we have there is that Ofsted doesn't inspect admissions practices at all. So when they look at the inclusion of a school, they're looking at how inclusive it is for the pupils who are enrolled there, but they're not looking at whether all the pupils with SEND are being sent to the school down the road. That's clearly a key problem.
A professor who had a profound impact on me personally, a business school professor, in fact, said that my job, Will, I was in my 20s, my job as a professor is to establish what is the talent of every single one of my students, you know, ensure they recognize it, mm-hmm. and then try and help them cultivate it. Mm-hmm. And it was a way of thinking about teaching that's been with me all my life, actually, ever since. And actually, he set me on, I wouldn't be sitting here without him telling me that. And the encouragement he gave me to write and broadcast. I mean, in a business school, come on. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether the conversation should be turned inside out. I mean, often some of the geniuses, you know, the kind of Einsteins, you know, the Marie Curies, you know, or the people who are very good at sport are people who have learning difficulties or ADHD or some such. And far from defining it as a problem, one should actually be asking a different question, you know, how, given the fact that you suffer from this, or suffer's not the right word, experience this, that may nonetheless be open a pathway to do something brilliant, you know. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, I just think that one should turn it inside out. I'm sorry. Anyway, that's just, I mean.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just think about the number of adults you meet who say, oh, yeah, no, I hated school. I never got on with school. But after school, I was able to pursue my passion and, you know, find my tribe and find my niche. And I just think that's so sad. Like, why should they have to suffer through school to get to the end of it? And I think that's very often how parents of pupils with SEND feel, is that we're sort of saying to them, just wait, you've just got to get through this. You know, everybody has to go to school, but once you get out of school, you'll be able to do your own thing and follow, you know, your interests. And surely that isn't what we should aspire to from our education system.
Just to kind of round up now, I mean, a few words of how you would characterize the system at the moment, and then a few words about your hopes for the future.
I think the system at the moment is very highly pressured. for everybody involved. So staff in schools are dealing with escalating needs on limited budgets, and I think have real concerns about whether even the level of investment set out in the white paper will be enough. Councils are in a very difficult position because they have statutory duties that they're not adequately resourced for. So they're forced into a defensive position where they're having to try and resist giving the support that's needed, which is, you know, it's not nice to be in that position either. And then, of course, families, you know, words like exhausted, humiliated, despondent, battling, fighting. That's what you hear from SEND parents all the time. You know, I'm just trying to get my child access to the education that they're entitled to, and I have to turn into some kind of superhero to make that happen. And there's an issue about equity there as well, of course, which is that some parents have the time, knowledge, and confidence to do that.
And also the spread of resource between local authorities. I mean, it varies hugely by local authority to local authority.
Absolutely. There's geographical variation. So that's how I would describe the system at the moment. In terms of
hopes, that's pretty devastating.
Yes. Let me say something hopeful. Most people with a stake in this believe that the vision that the government's setting out of more inclusive mainstream education, earlier access to expert support, earlier identifications of need is a good one. We, you know, there are certainly some key concerns, and we might question whether they're focusing too much on mainstream and not paying attention to alternative and special forms of education. But I don't think that amounts to an argument that we shouldn't make mainstream schools more inclusive. So there's hope there. There's the will, and there's £4 billion of investment over the next 3 years to try and make it happen. I think whether it will bring costs down, whether it will lead to a solution to the problem is really going to be all in the implementation. And we're going to have to see how that plays out. And hopefully Nuffield will fund some research to track that and get the answers.
Alice, thank you very much. Very illuminating kind of deep dive into a corner of the educational forest that I certainly hadn't really explored sufficiently until I interviewed you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistle Down production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.